Lucy's wedding day began clear and bright and beautiful, all we could wish. What I remember of the morning was a montage. I put on the white hostess robe that Lyndon had bought me in Paris 10 years ago. Went in to see Lucy. She was eating her breakfast while Aunt Jean-Louis was doing her hair. A vintage screen, rescued from some musty storehouse, last used in FDR's day, I think. Decorated with scenes of Vesuvius erupting and streets of Roman cities, stretched across the East Hall. Adding what had become a beauty parlor for the day. There were tables and mirrors and chairs and dryers and chattering bridesmaids in robes or already in their pink dresses, with their hair being teased into high hairdos by Mr. George and one of Jean-Louis' girls, and he himself running in and out. An hilarious scene. I'd ask Helen to be the guardian of the 58-year-old Rose Point lace handkerchief made by Lucy's great-grandmother, Ruth Ahmet Huffman Baines, for the wedding of her daughter, Aunt Josepha Baines Saunders. It had stayed until Bessie's safe until this morning, and it was her treasured something old to carry. A link with her grandmother's family. Her something new was her wedding dress, of course. Will it be the something old for a bride in the future? I hope so. And the rosary given by Pope John to Linda Bird will be her something borrowed. The something blue was a gold locket tied with a blue satin ribbon. It belonged to Mrs. Nugent and contained baby pictures of Pat and Gerard Jr. And then this is where the public gets in. She actually was going to wear a sixpence in her shoe. The first of many she received. It was from Adele Rosoki, and it had come back in March. Linda Bird was running around singing, "Get Me to the Church on Time." The gayest, most helpful, most efficient, no surprise, of any of the bridesmaids. I dressed early. If the day is to be flawless, we must all be on time. Went upstairs to see Mrs. Nugent. She was lovely in a blue lace dress made by a Waukegan designer. Downstairs in the state dining room, into which the press and cameras will move as soon as we've departed for the church, I saw the great exquisite chandelier, intertwined with clumps of delicate white flowers, freesias, I believe, and a trace of greenery. I just wish every guest would pause and look upward above the crowd. It was a dream. In the Lincoln Room, Priscilla, putting the last touches on the bridesmaids' dresses and arranging their veils, and then into Lucy's room. Never did a bride dress with more care and more delight. She was really radiant. Lyndon, the bridesmaid, left on time, and Lyndon and Lucy. He looked so handsome. I was so proud of him. A cutaway was meant for a tall man, a commanding man. And then Mrs. Nugent and I were in the car following them. At the bottom of the long steps, Mrs. Nugent disappeared quietly on the arm of an aide to go to the elevator. She lives with this problem, with complete lack of self-consciousness and great dignity. We tried to remember all those who would need the elevator, Ruth, Sam Houston. We'd asked those accompanying them to locate it ahead of time to avoid confusion. But alas, we had forgotten Senator Dirksen, who'd arrived on crutches. Then I was going up the stairs with an aide, and we paused on the first landing and the second landing. And there were pictures of the three of us, Lyndon, Lucy, I. Inside the church, we went to the bridesmaids' rooms to wait. There was Corky, starched and solemn in his white suit. But some grown person was holding the precious white satin pillow, lace-edged, on which the rings reposed. Lucy's twin small bands and Pat's simple larger band, securely tied with ribbons until the fateful moment. And Bader, in her long white dress, with a tiny pink design at the waist, her flowers clutched in a simple straw basket. Mrs. Nugent and I were the first down the line, she, at her request, between two Marines. A small salute to Jerry, who is on Hill something or other in Vietnam. He couldn't cable. There was none close by. But later we got a message. Mr. and Mrs. Pat Nugent, congratulations, Patty and Lucy. Sorry I cannot be there, but you know how it is. See you in September. Best wishes, Jerry. And he toasted them in sea rations. One walks up the aisle as though in a play, thinking not the deep thoughts that this is the last moment. She belongs to us alone. I had read all that in the Bible up in the West Hall one night earlier in the week. But looking at the great pageantry of the altar and the mosaic of Christ above it, swept along on the tide of music from that magnificent organ, caressing with my eyes the little white bouquets of flowers that marked the ends of pews, the artistic work of Mr. Nelson and Mr. Young, to what hour, I wonder, the topiary trees, white roses, and white carnations. One of the minor crises was to discover that Lucy was allergic to carnations, so we had to switch to roses close to the altar. And then, as we approached our seat, glancing to see if the instructions for Section C had been carried out. Yes, there was Nelly, John III and Sharon with a good view, and the West and the Morrisons. But I was afraid the last row in Section C had too many people for a good view. And as I sat down, I reached quietly behind me to put my hand on Elaine's and on Aunt Ellen's, and to throw a smile at Tony and Matiana. She was lovely in a large apricot organza hat. A credit to the family and a joy to Tony, she is. I felt a warm tide of love as I walked down the aisle. There were so many who had meant so much in Lucy's life from the moment she entered the world. Our missal had been marked stand, sit, kneel, one of the 1,001 logistical triumphs for Bess, who, knowing that we, sitting on the front row, would have difficulty following the ritual. Down the aisle they came, Phyllis Nugent first, I believe, and then all the bridesmaids, each one lovely. Betty Beale and Sharon Chapman, absolutely enchanting. And Helene Lindo, to whom I've come to feel so close. And then there was the moment for Lucy and her father. She was flawless in her dignity and gentleness. And when she reached the foot of the steps leading to the altar, she turned to her father, patted him on the shoulder. He gave her to Pat and took his seat by me. Be it said to his eternal credit that I do not remember his looking at his watch one time in a service that lasted longer than an hour. The missal was worth all the artistic effort that went into it. The elegant binding, the gold drawing of the shrine on the outside, the words on the first page, bound by the strength of their love, their hope, their joy in their life together, marriage becomes a golden chalice, capable of containing all their trials and happiness when taken as one in the name of Jesus Christ. Very fitting for these two young people. I think all the credit once more must go to Bess, her research, her organization, and to Sandy Fox, his artistic hand. Never once, so far as I could see, did Pat and Lucy fail in the complete dignity and grace of their deportment in this interminable ceremony. At one point, I saw Helene Lindo rise from her kneeler and disappear very quietly into the wings. I knew she must be faint. Why should they not? The bright lights, the emotional strain, the forever kneeling. But it was like Helene to do it with this minimum of notice. Hale Boggs read the epistle in a clear, commanding voice. I was glad that so good a friend, so strong a Catholic, had been chosen by Lucy to do it. I strained, we all strained, to hear the answers to the questions put to the bride and the groom. We could not. They were not equipped with the mics, as were the priests who participated in the ceremony. And then there came a fateful moment when I saw Linda at her kneeler put her head completely down. From then on, I watched only her. I turned the pages of the missal to see how much longer. We were, as I remember, about on page 19, the Lord's Prayer, and I prayed for it to be over soon. A priest went across and spoke to her. She shook her head. I was tensely hoping for Dr. Young and smelling salts. I knew there were smelling salts close by for just such emergencies. Where, I didn't know. Any movement on my part would be too conspicuous. And then suddenly she slumped to an almost sitting position at her kneeler. But even this was graceful. Another priest approached. She shook her head. He brought a chair. She did sit in it, and gradually her head went up. Later, Jesse told me, Jesse Kellum, that instead of praying for it to be over, he was praying for every moment longer that it lasted because he knew her strength would be returning. His background as an athlete, as a coach, I know he was wiser than me. But I could see her daddy straining, wanting to go to her, knowing that he couldn't. And then they were offering the Holy Communion, using the Texas chalice. And then, very soon, it was all over. At the last moment, Archbishop O'Ball read a telegram of congratulations to the young couple from the Pope, sent, I believe, in the name of the Secretary of State at the Vatican. This, a surprise, to me at least. And then Lucy and Pat, arm in arm, her little face with a look of transport, Pat dignified and steady, walked toward us. And Linda rose, head high, in command of the situation. And John, the best man. What a young 50-year-old Mr. Nugent is. And then my heart stopped. When Lucy and Pat reached the steps, they did not come down. They turned to the right, walked solemnly into a little chapel, and were gone for moments. I remembered St. Agatha, the patron saint of nurses. Lucy was going to give her bouquet to her. My thoughts were not on St. Agatha, but on the profession she was the patron saint of, nursing. My eyes were fixed on Linda, as she stood with Mr. Nugent, quite steadily, quite gracefully, for what seemed an interminable time, until Lucy returned to lead her attendants down the aisle. But no, once more she turned to the left. She stopped and kissed me and gave me a rose from her bouquet and kissed her daddy. And then she crossed to the other side of the aisle and kissed Mrs. Nugent and gave her a rose. And then she and Pat were walking radiantly, joyously down the aisle. And I'm sure that church full of people breathed a sigh of relief. The bridesmaids and the ushers went down two by two. As Susan Ray passed, I thought she looked as though she would faint any moment. She made it almost to the door, and then was gently carried to one side for smelling salts and rest. Linda and I paused on the way out, so that when we emerged, we were one of the crowd. We made our way down the steps. Lucy, in a billow of white, in the bubble top, with Pat by her side, was waving to the people who had gathered to see her. I myself did not see the pickets. I understand there were some somewhere. And this time, Lyndon joined me and Mrs. Nugent for the drive to the White House, down Rhode Island Avenue, along which way I carefully counted all the cherry trees that the Society for a More Beautiful Capital had put out this spring, to see how many were dying or dead. It was crushing. I counted 61. It's been about the worst drought of any summer that we can remember. They're guaranteed for 1 year, so it will be the nursery's loss. Where can they find other trees as handsome for replacement? And it will mean an aesthetic, a psychological blow. So now it is time to put aside wedding veils and missiles and take up blue bonnet seeds and cherry trees. Or it will be when the day is over. We had a few minutes on the second floor to recoup before we all grouped in the green room. Lucy and Pat, the two sets of parents, all the bride's grooms and ushers, and then out onto the portico. The first picture was Pat and Lucy and the Nugents and Lyndon and me, standing at the railing, facing the battery of all the nation's press and TV, rather pleasantly concealed behind blooming crepe myrtles in pots, taller trees, willows, I believe, and petunias, all of which will belong later to some park in the town. And behind them, the calm promise of the Jefferson Memorial and the Washington Monument. And then we were joined by Linda. She was fine, one of the bravest things I'd seen. Her at the top of the steps, kneeling to arrange her sister's train as her sister started the descend from the shrine. And then for a moment came the matron of honor, Susan Ray, quite recovered. Then all the bridesmaids and groomsmen who descended the winding stairs. Their names had been pasted on the steps in the dry run the day before. And Linda Bird moved to the head of the stairs after the bride and groom were in their position. She was joined by Mr. Nugent, and it was time for Lyndon and I and Mrs. Nugent to re-enter the White House through the green room. Over my shoulder, I cast one last look, and there were the cute young members of the wedding party, Beta and Corky, down front. I flared upstairs, take off my hat, and put myself in the hands of Mr. Jean-Louis. He and Helen, by magic, had arrived in good time for their necessary jobs. I knew that downstairs, on the steps, Lucy and Pat and Linda and Mr. Nugent would pause midway of the stairs for more pictures, and then the bride and groom alone. Later, I heard that when Lucy saw the dogs held by Mr. Bryant out on the lawn a few feet away, she added her own bit to the carefully thought-out agenda, went down and kneeled, and told the dogs goodbye, much to the delight of the cameraman. When my hair was done, I took my little rose that Lucy had given me from her bouquet and went into the yellow room with the family Bible. I sat down at the desk and wrote in the Bible that Mrs. Johnson had given us for the first Christmas in our forever home, the ranch. Very carefully, I wrote time and place and date. of Lucy's wedding, and I pressed the rose in that page. It was a little after 2:30, and we all gathered in the blue room for the receiving line. Lyndon, with Lucy and Pat next to him, and then Mrs. Nugent and I, and Mr. Nugent at the end of the line. This so I could explain to both of them, and they to me, that this was Ann Pittman, one of Lucy's fifth grade friends, and this was Ag Neff, who owned her beloved Camp Mystic, and this Dr. John Washington, who had taken care of Lucy from the day she was born. She was quite a grown young lady.
Never.
And they could tell me who all the Waukegan cousins and aunts were, and the great flock of clergy. Never was there such a hugging and kissing receiving line, and I would have had it no other way. Long and tiring, true, but dear and forever to be remembered. By me, I think by many. The first 10 minutes were televised with great glaring lights, particularly pointed, of course, at Lyndon and Lucy and Pat. And I was happy that some of them near and dear came down through that time. I believe the Secretary of State and Virginia and my brother Tony and Matiana and Doris and Hugh Powell, whom I introduced to the Nugents, as Lucy's Aunt Dee Dee, with whom she had spent so many summers. And I think Senator Dirksen, on crutches, was in those first 10 minutes. It, too, is all a montage to me now. But he was greeted with a great kiss. And when the 10 minutes were over, there was a pause, and the doors were shut, and the receiving line stopped, while all the machinery of television was rolled away, except what lights were left for our own Lieutenant Atkins and Bob Knudsen and Okamoto, and a moment for us to have a bit of a drink. And then the receiving line continued. I was deeply proud that our official family, the Vice President, and all the 11 members of the Cabinet were there. And this was no breaking of the feeling that this was a personal family wedding. Lyndon and I and Lucy have come to feel very close to these fellow workers of ours. As I looked at Hubert and Muriel, Margie and Bob, Jane and Bill, I knew that very soon they too would be going through this. And in venerable old Christ Church, not long ago, we'd watched the wedding of Trudy and Joe's daughter. And then from the court, there were the Chief Justice and Mrs. Warren, our two specially dear friends, the Hugo Blacks, and Bill Douglas, whose 23-year-old wife was necessarily of very much interest to the photographers. Our friends for longer than Lucy has lived, Tom Clarks, and Abe and Carol, he has held my hand in so many major decisions through all of this, through always before. And from the Senate, not nearly enough. But Birch and Marvella By, with whom Lucy had campaigned, Gretchen Bird, without Harry, who's at the bedside of his dying father. Lucy had lived at their home, and she was Apple Blossom Princess. And besides Senator Dirksen, Paul Douglas, and Emily from Pat's state of Illinois, and Warren and Jermaine Magnuson, he'd gotten Pat a job on the Hill. Our dear friend, whom Lucy has called all her life Uncle Dick Russell. Stu and Evie Symington, who picked her as his favorite in our family when she was about 2 years old. And the Herman Talmadges, at whose house Lucy used to stop on her way home from school and raid their icebox. And the Ralph Yarbers from Texas. And old friends who watched her grow up, the Clinton Andersons and the Mike Monrones and the George Smathers. Only a sprinkling, I believe, there were others, but I figure I've spent 30-odd years of my life filling my public role with great pleasure and as much thoughtfulness and wisdom as I have. And this is our private day. From the house was leader Carl Albert and his daughter Mary Frances, one of Lucy's friends from NCS, and her great campaigning friends who practically turned their home into a boarding house for some of the Waukegan kinfolks and friends, and their daughter Cokie, and their son Tommy and his wife, with whom Lucy has campaigned, and the Jack Brooks, who've listened to all of Lucy's romances these last 5 years or so, and Speaker and Mrs. McCormick, who were present at Lucy's confirmation when not even I was there, and for whom she has a most tender and deep bond, Jake Pickle, our own congressman, and his pretty daughter Peggy, and old-timers who came with us, the George Mahons and the Bob Pogues, and Lyra Thomas. He used to give Lyndon advice on how to doctor the children when I was away from home. And the Wright Patmans, and the Graham Purcells, for whom Lucy used to babysit, and a sprinkling more. I was honored that the Arthur Goldbergs were there, and the Averill Harrimans, to whom I've become increasingly close, and the George McGees, Linda's dear favorites, and the Bill Deasons, sitting close to us, with Sam Houston, who looks strained and emotional. A special bond that Lucy has with Bill Deason is that he's the godfather of all the dogs. It was a long kiss for Nellie Connolly when she came down the line in blue lace, though I missed the tall, handsome presence of John. And the two youngsters who used to play in the backyard at 1901 Dillman, Johnny and Sharon. My one regret of the day is that I couldn't talk, really talk, to each of those I loved. The staff was there in good number, though I would have loved to have had everyone. And it was a long hug and a tear, I think, for Zephyr and for Helen and for Willie Day. It was a deep moment for me when Jim and Ida Mae Kane came down the line with Kitty Mae Wirtz and memories of that man that does not die in our hearts, Senator Wirtz, who had been Lucy's godfather in the Episcopal Church. And how glad I was to see Willis Hurst and his wife. These two doctors have taken such a personal, loving interest in those girls as they've grown up. And of course, for Dr. Turchin and Dr. Kraskin, they felt she was in part their production. Catholic clergy was there in great number, many of them among the Nugent's closest friends. I was so happily impressed with Father John Kuczynskis, a strong, very masculine, 40-year-old or so man who radiated confidence in those two young folks. But I was glad to see my own Bill Baxter and his wife there, and Dr. John Barkley from Austin, who participated in both inaugurals with his sweet wife, Bee, and his daughter, Betsy. And Lyndon's Dr. George Davis. But there was a sadness that there were not more kinfolks there. I missed the Alexanders and their newly married little Becky. I was sorry the Bobbitts couldn't be there. And the T.J. Taylors III, but they had had a good week with us earlier in the summer. And Winston. But I rejoiced in the presence of Tony and Martiana, who enjoyed it to the fullest. Had a good visit with the Lawrence Rockefellers and the U-Dolls. And, of course, there was Patsy and our fiancé. And Ava, who taught Linda Bird for 2 years and Lucy for one, and to whom this will be a real and lasting and dear memory. And there was Lyndon's niece, Roxanne, and mine, Diana and Donald. The young Griffin Tatums, my cousins. And from the older Alabama generation, Aunt Ellen Taylor Cooper. And the never old and always vibrant Elaine Pachessa. And among those to whom it meant most, Ruth Taylor, who was being escorted around by the Donald Thomases. There could have been a reunion of Camp Mystic. Side Ag, there was Inez Harrison and Theda Bain and Carol Henry, a counselor, and Jane Rommel and Ken Sue Shear and Terry Taylor, and members of the wedding party, Kathleen Carter and Patty McGuirk, and of course Sharon Connolly. And there could have been a little reunion of the fifth grade at Cassis with Vashti Mirage, besides Betty Beale and Ann Pittman. One of the stars of the show was certainly Alice Roosevelt Longworth. I wish I could hear her impressions, or do I? She was most ably escorted by Dick Dickerson. And Liz, with her quick thinking, stopped the line as she came down and said, "It's not often that you get a chance to see two brides in the White House side by side, so I hope they got a good picture, separated by their span of 60 years. But joined in this very unique sharing of their wedding days in the White House." Jane Engelhard came down the line. I murmured how I adored the apple pickers. Mm-hmm. And Rebecca Harkness, she was beautiful in a printed flowing chiffon, blue and green, like a Monet landscape. We exchanged a conspiratorial glance. And no woman was handsomer than Ovita Culp-Hobby, who defeats the years. Mary Griffith and Dorothy Parker and Miss Trez and I all had a special hug for each other, because of the years we've tried to dress that child. And there was old friend Clark Clifford, who has held my hand, just as Abe has, and whose daughter's weddings I have watched lovingly. And there could really have been an NCS reunion, led by Miss Catherine Lee, whom I had placed with the family group. And there was Mrs. Warry, Gray Baxter, and Nancy Heckinger, and Marlene Johnson, and Lissy Grant, and many whom I didn't recognize. For Lucy, it would not have been complete without her Secret Service and their wives. I think she could carry that precinct. They love her. There were old staff members, the Mac George Bundys. My mother, he remembered Pat's name before you did. And the Horace Busbys and the George Reedys and the Jack Heights. And Marjorie Jenkins. I'm so happy she came. And Dorothy and Phil Nichols. And of course, the Jack Valentis. And among our special friends, the Warren Woodwards of the Woodward Date Bureau. And the Will Edward Odoms. And the Frank Stantons. And our longtime neighbors, in whose home the children were as much at home as in our own, Homer and Eloise Thornberry. with Molly, and the Ed Wiesels and the Bill Whites, and the Arthur Krims, who've taken them both in when they needed to visit New York. I wanted a chaperone, and I'm still not quite sure whether all of Peter, Paul, and Mary were there, but at least two of them were. I had both a sob and a smile. Paul and Dolly Bolton came bravely down the line, and Jesse Kellum, both of us thinking how much Louise would have enjoyed this, how much she would have helped. And Jesse Hunter, and from the ranch, the Dale Malachecks, some of Lucy's close friends from Georgetown, both faculty and students. And George Hamilton, who did his courtly best to remain in the background. And old beaux, Tommy Fowett, and Paul Betts, and Terry O'Rourke, and Sidney Kaplan, and David Corcoran. As one reporter aptly put it, it was shoulder to shoulder with the notables, were lesser known figures, neighbors of the Nugents, former neighbors of the Johnsons, doctors and dentists, lawyers and preachers, camp counselors, ranch workers, college classmates, relatives. And that is what I loved about it, and each with a bond to Lucy. The line did go slow. Twice we halted it for a breather. But a little past four, it was over. One part of my mind is always wondering what the guests were doing who were waiting. I found, to my happiness, that a great many of them had paused on their way in the lovely pink tent in the Jacqueline Kennedy Garden for drinks and plates from the ample buffet, for a breather after the long service and before the long line. And once more, I was grateful for Bessie's planning. In the East Room, the cake rose like a great glistening Taj Mahal. Its seven tiers decorated swans and white roses and lacy arches like cathedral windows. I suppose they were sugary confection. Between the tiers, the whole topped the bouquet of lilies of the valley. Lucy and Pat and Lyndon and I stepped up on a small raised platform behind the cake table, and all the vast array of the press, cameras, lights, shone on us. And Lucy picked up the cake knife that Birch and Marvella By had gave her to match her silver, and began to cut into the third or fourth layer of Ferdinand's work of art. It was hard. He tried another layer. Pat put his hand to it. Lyndon added his to the knife. Off came a lovely piece. Bridesmaids were grouped around us. Guests clustered beyond them. She gave me the first piece, a bite for Pat, another piece, I don't know who that went to, and then she turned it over to a professional and went on the dance floor. And now it is all medley and confusion to me. Next to Peter Duchin's orchestra were swirls of pink bridesmaids and dark-suited groomsmen, some of the livelier young guests, and Lucy and Pat. And I was circulating to a few old friends, saying, let's go to the state dining room, or rest ourselves in the red room, or see what the tent looks like, and give these young folks a chance to dance. I had a goodbye kiss for Doris, who will return at 7, and introduced her to Pearl Mester. I knew that would thrill her, and to a couple of the cabinet members. I told Ag and Inez they should have a reunion of Camp Mystic Girls with a picture all together. I looked in vain for dear Dr. and Mrs. Reed. I sat down briefly in the pink tent. George and Alice Brown and Ovita and Nancy and Nellie Connolly. By now it was nearly empty, everyone upstairs. And then, at a little past 5, I went upstairs to see about Operation Departure. There, for the first time, in this day of wonderful precision, logistics that worked, I came face to face with a crisis of planning. Lucy's going-away costume had gone away. He had carefully planned for certain suitcases to go with the first Secret Service man, the destination honeymoon, and those that would be needed for the night to be taken earlier to the getaway car. The going-away costume itself, a beautiful deep pink, very like a bridesmaid's, in fact, with a pink floral turban, was to have remained behind in the closet. It had not. Lucy was adamant. She would not throw her bouquet in her bridal costume and then slip quietly away in the most inconspicuous old school outfit in the closet. After great struggle, we sent for the dress and hat. It was fully an hour later. Our guests milled around downstairs, dancing, eating, having champagne, waiting impatiently on the lawn. And Liz came in with a harried look, wanting to know what could she tell them she needed to put the lid on if Lucy had departed. And then, a little past 6, Lucy glowing in her lovely going-away costume, and Pat and Lyndon and I went to the first floor balcony, where down below on the ground were ranged all the bridesmaids and those remaining guests, each with a little bag of rice tied in pink net. Lucy carefully threw her bouquet. It fell closest to Linda. She retrieved it.
Rice.
Little bags of rice filled the air. And with a wave and a hug, "And Mother, you've given us the most beautiful wedding," breathed in my ear. And reaching up once more like a little girl instead of a bride to be tall enough to kiss her daddy, a last look at the crowd, Lucy and Pat were gone, but not quite gone. Operation Departure was from then on nobody's business but Bob Kohler's and Lucy's and Pat's and mine, or so I believe. It was only a few minutes later that I went to Lucy's room to find her not there. "That child that it takes forever to dress had in 5 minutes' time," Helen said, "put on her most inconspicuous little dark dress and Jean-Louis' wedding gift, a half hairpiece that looks like casual shoulder-length curls. She hadn't left the house. She was somewhere, waiting for Bob Kohler's word that all was in readiness. I went upstairs, where Mrs. Nugent had long ago gone to rest. Mrs. Nugent was curled up on the sofa. She never mentions her leg, but it had been one grueling day for her, I know. And there was Lucy, sweetly beside her, looking like the Lucy that ought to pick up an algebra book and a Latin book and get off to school. We were tensely waiting for the phone. In a minute, the call came. Lucy kissed us both and was off down the hall, rushing. I followed her to the elevator. I watched it go down. I knew that it was supposed to go to B, or so I thought, and that they would go out through the tunnel, into the treasury, into the garage, from there into the car, and on the floor of the car, an inconspicuous black sedan, to New York, to spend the night at Mary Lasker's townhouse. Down with the elevator, from 3 to 2 to 1, back to 1 mezzanine. My heart almost stopped. It did not go on to B. I do not know what happened. I shall have to wait till she returns, if ever, to find out. I waited a few minutes, and by now it was 6:30. I had only a breather before the guests that I had invited to come and watch the TV shows with me would arrive. They started in at 6:45 and found the wedding reception still going on. It was 7:10 before the music died away, and the last of the wedding guests drifted out. I'd gathered in the yellow oval room, Tony and Martiana and Diana and Donna, dear Elaine and the Griffin Tatums, and Doris and Hugh, and Diana and Dudley, the Philip Baldwins, and Aunt Ellen and Ava. Lyndon came in to be with us, and the Ganellas stopped by, and he made them stay. We had 3 television sets in the yellow room, and we all grouped around it, resting our feet, having a drink, and watching the day we had lived through. Nancy Dickerson's program about the wedding was magnificent. Lyndon and I called her and thanked her. Part of it was her superb professional sense, and part her insight and her real closeness to Lucy and Pat and to us. It made me feel remiss in not having helped see that there was some commentator on the other two who knew us better. Goodness knows there had been efforts. They'd tried to hide Cokie Boggs, some network had, and very earnestly they'd tried to hire June White. It smacked a bit of a guest using an invitation in a rather commercial way, but it would have been, probably, a more perceptive show. I brought out the bouquet of lilies of the valley that had been on top of the wedding cake and gave each of the ladies present one to press for their memory books or whatever they wanted. Lyndon went off and took the Ganellas with him to the Deasons, who were going to gather all of the Austin people at their house for drinks and buffet supper and reminiscences. And then the rest of us settled down. The plates which we helped ourselves from the Daniel Webster buffet in the family dining room, the very first buffet of that sort I remember here in this house. And back we went to the Truman balcony to exchange our own vignettes of the day. And Doris told me about plans in Karnak by the Improvement Association to try to buy the old store from Daddy's estate for a community center. But they had planted the little circle where the highway approaches his store with shrubs and flowers and were keeping it up rather well. And about hopes for improving the Caddo State Park. One of the state garden clubs is going on to take a project to plant wildflowers in it. And there are enough hours in the day and energy in me, I want to be a part of it all. Tony had had a great good time, seeing old friends, meeting new ones. He's been such a part of our life up here. And Ava said that nothing we could ever have done for her would have equaled this invitation. The Truman balcony was flooded with memories and love as we all said goodbye, very weary at an early hour before 10 o'clock, and I with one ear cocked for any news over the TV or radio about the children's whereabouts, was relieved that no word had come. By 11 o'clock, I was in bed, and Lyndon was home from the Deasons, and the great, great day was over. Happily, beautifully, to our heart's delight, a part of the memories of this great White House.